Now, have you on the screen? Wonderful. It's all over, Sandy. It's good. All right. That's fine. No, that's not awesome. Awesome. So we're talking about illustrations that Moses uses in Deuteronomy, and the way that he uses giants, these creatures or persons described as Nephilim or Rephaim, in the book of Deuteronomy. He focuses on them several times, and particularly in this section we've been looking at, he refers to them in the context of this bits of land that you can have, bits of land you can't have. But there are various references we're going to look at tonight where he picks out these giants in the land as well. There are 30 different references in Moses' writing to the giants, these people called the giants. And these are direct references to the Nephilim and the Rephaim. And you'll find them in the book of Genesis. Perhaps some of you will remember at early parts of Genesis chapter 6, there's references to the giants there. Moses talks about them again in the book of Numbers. Do you remember the incident? They come to the border and they go and gather the grapes, don't they? And they come back and what do they say? There's giants in the land, right? And then here in Deuteronomy, he picks up on that again and he talks about giants. He focuses on giants. But it's not just Moses who talks about them. In Joshua, understandably, because they're going into the land where there's giants. And then in 2 Samuel, because the giants are not completely dealt with, and so they're contending with the giants as well. It's in 1 Chronicles, the situation persists into 1 Chronicles, and then there's even some references into the book of Isaiah. So the problem of giants is a problem that besets the people of God for generation after generation after generation. So sometimes there are problems that just don't go away. This is a problem that just does not seem to go away. And there's this kind of shadow that these people, this long shadow that these people cast over the people of God. There's something about these giants that affects their kind of their psyche, their ability to make progress and be the people that God is calling them to be. Now, the word Nephil, the Hebrew word Nephil, means to cause to fall, to cause to fall. And when you put it in the participle form, if you're a grammatical kind of thinking person, it means a fella. And by a fella, I don't mean a good bloke. I mean a person who cuts down trees. Okay? A fella. So the Nephil are fellas. But the thing about the Nephil, and the things that they fell, I think the main emphasis, though they may cut down trees, the real concern that the people of God have is that they're going to cut down us. Because evidently these people are a powerful people, and if they can take down a tree, then they can take down you. And that's what makes people so nervous. These are the proverbial lumberjacks. You've got a picture of the lumberjack, can't you? You know, he's built like a barn door. I suppose we've been watching a lot of rugby recently. At least I have. I don't know about the rest of you. But when you're watching the rugby, you see these guys like Charteris, the Welsh Charteris, 6'9", right? 6'9". Toner, Devon Toner. 6'10", big chaps. I mean, I was always amazed by this church, how many tall guys we have at this church. It's really quite something, isn't it? I feel like a grasshopper in their sight. I really do. There's Rod, there's of course yourself, and Roy, you're here, and there's the two Chrises, and then there's Richard, and then there's, it just goes on, doesn't it? Phil, of course. And Steve, you know, he's quite a tall chap. And Isaac's gone past 6 foot, hasn't he, already? And Andy, when he's here as well, he's quite a tall chap. So there's quite a few 6 foot. But, you know, 6'10", it's really quite something, isn't it? That's a big lad. And most of you, though you're tall, it's mostly this way, right? It's mostly vertical. But, you know, you look at some of the rugby players, they've got the horizontal looks as well, haven't they? Like Skelton, the Australian, 22 stone, 1 pound, 6'7" high. It's a big chap, isn't it? And that's not the biggest. Francis Antonio is 22 stone, 9 pounds. Can you imagine that? That's a fairly sizable chap. And they're all in their 20s. These are guys in their 20s and their early 30s. And they could cut you down, couldn't they? They could mow you down. That's the point. They are Nephil in that regard, aren't they? They're like the Nephilim. Now, the other word that gets used is the Raphaim. The Rapha, and that's an unusual term because Rapha is often translated Jehovah Rapha, the Lord our healer. It means to heal or to mend or to fix. But it also gets translated in other places to cut down in the same way as we've been talking about. The thing that healing and cutting down have in common is that to heal, you invest vigor and life into something, energy. And I think that what is in common between cutting something down and fixing something up is it requires energy and strength. So this is what I'm reading in the commentaries. So in the same way, the emphasis on the Raphaim is that these men are strong. They're not just big, they are strong. And they're fit. You know, there's something about these people, the Raphaim, the Nephilim. And there's also a bit of a pun in the word Raphaim, which sounds a little bit like a phrase which means dead ancestors, as if something to do with their strength is almost like a spiritual strength. When you watch the beginning, when the All Blacks come out on the pitch and they do the haka, right? You get the feeling that they're invoking the spirit of their ancestors. It's almost something spiritual to their strength. And the Nephilim and the Raphaim, there's something almost a spiritual energy about them, a spiritual strength about these people that's pretty intimidating. And I know we've got some, you know, Rich is a good runner, and I know Phil's really a very good runner. It's good levels of fitness, but these rugby players, I know I'm not going to spend the whole evening talking about the rugby, by the way, but it's worth just for illustration's point. From a deadlift, in other words, just picking it up off the ground, these men are able to pick. So we know this guy is 22 stone 9 pounds. He's able to pick up twice his own body weight. Okay? And when you're doing a bench press, which is lying on your back and pushing it up, 1.5 times your body weight. And when you're doing pull-ups, your body weight plus half again. That's just phenomenal strength these people had. And when it comes to speed, they're able to cover 10 meters in 1.6 seconds. And for illustration, so you can just imagine all that weight, that size, that strength coming at you at that speed. For illustration, Usain Bolt, when he broke the 100-meter record, did the first 10 meters in 1.89 seconds. In other words, these rugby players are coming at you faster than Usain Bolt when he gets off the blocks. They don't have to do the full 100 yards. But they continue to play and run on the field for 80 long minutes so they can endure out on the field as well. I'm just painting you a picture of remarkable strength and vigor and athleticism. And that comes about by diet and hydration and careful monitoring and ice baths and 6 meals a day. And they have to keep their fat levels down to 10% of the body weight is allowed to be fat. A bodybuilder is 3.5% body fat. Most of us, 20% plus. But the Nephilim and the Raphaim, they're not just sportsmen contending for a cup and for glory and for honor. These are warriors. The game, this is not a game they're playing. They're going to kill you. That's what they're training to do. That's what all that investment and strengthening and diet and preparation and monitoring is all about, to kill you, to take you out for good. No wonder the people of God had a problem with these people for generation after generation. Because, and it's not just their strength and their size and their, but it's their ability as well. The skill, when you see the description of all the weapons that the greatest of the giants, the most famous of the giants, Goliath, he was able to fight with a sword and fight with a javelin and fight with a spear. They were skillful, fast. You watch the rugby players, quick thinking, strategic. It's all happening and it's in real time, but this is for keeps. This is for keeps. So, anybody ready to go out and fight? Anybody feeling the mood for a bust up with these guys? And they were in the mountains that God had given them to possess. These were the owners, the defenders of their territory. And not just that, as you read all the way through, they're in their fortifications with their iron bars and their high walls. This is a substantial challenge to your faith, to the basic conviction that this land is going to be yours. One day, you are going to live in that place. You're going to pluck the cherries off the tree and eat them, and not them. That is quite a challenge to your faith, isn't it? These are the heroes. Like the Greek Achilles and all the rest of it. These are the heroes. We see them in the movies, don't they? They're all massively muscular, and the weapons and all the rest of it, and they go steaming into. Here they are. This is the real thing. This is the real thing. And they, if you touch them, if you touch their territory, if you enter their land, they are at war with you. So you think carefully, don't you? You think carefully before you go taking them on. And they're there all the way. They're there all the way from Genesis through to the book of Kings. And there are plenty of them challenging God's people. I don't know if you ever have experienced, there's some things that are just like really just you're up against. You just, you know, and they seem impossible to overcome. They really are formidable, formidable challenges, formidable opposition. Let's not understate the opposition. And here's the thing, Israel, God's people, had how many such? None at all. In fact, the only record we have of their champions is when the choicest of their men were chosen to go into the promised land, and these were the chiefest of the men, and they say in their own words when they came back that we were as grasshoppers in their sight. That, in terms of stature, how I felt standing next to these people, we were absolutely tiny. So the best of the Israelites was like a midget compared to these great big men. The people who dwell in the land, this is what it said in Numbers 13:28, they are strong, their cities are fortified, they're very large, and we saw the descendants of Anak there, we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak who came from the Nephilim, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and we seemed also to them. So whether it was how they saw themselves or how the Nephilim, because that's interesting, the Nephilim saw the spies, and they looked at them and they went, nah, it's nothing, you're nothing. You're nobodies. You're nobodies. And that's how they saw themselves. We are nothing. We're nobodies. We can't do this. We can't do this. They are just simply too strong for us. They fought against the Egyptians with their horses and their chariots. They didn't have any of those. And now in the hill country, even if they did, they couldn't use them. All they had was their numbers. There were lots of them. There were lots of Israelites, and that was about it. We have a record in the book of Numbers, chapter 22, verse 3, that Moab said that he was in great dread of the people of Israel because they were so many. Yes, there were many of them. And Moab was overcome with fear because of the people of Israel. And this is in open plain warfare. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, the horde will now lick up all that's around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field. Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, and they're dwelling opposite me. Come now, curse this people for me. They are too mighty for me. Strength in numbers. They had strength in numbers. But they had no wonderful weapons. They had no supermen. They had no castles. They had just lots of these little people. Lots and lots of little people. And lots of hills to climb. And once you get big groups of people up in the hills, they all get lost, it all breaks down, and before you know it, you have met a giant. You have met a giant. The most famous, as we refer to, was Goliath. This comes later, doesn't it, in the days of David, because they were still in the land. And he's a champion, isn't he, fighting up in the hills and the valleys. And 1 Samuel 17, verse 4, gives us the reference to it. Shall I read it out to you, remind you of that? Confrontation came out of the camp of the Philistines, a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Well, I'm no good at doing the math side of it, but some people reckon that's 10 foot. I don't know, but one thing is clear, the guy is huge. He's absolutely huge. He had a helmet of bronze on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail, a and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had bronze armor on his legs, a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield bearer went before him, and he stood in the ranks of Israel. "Why have you come to draw us up for battle? Am I not the Philistine? Are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and afraid. Just their confidence just disappeared. The truth is, how many of you would be willing to go and fight, humanly speaking? It sounds familiar, doesn't it? Things come up. Things come up in our lives, and suddenly all our confidence, we meet in church, we praise God, and we say God is great, and so on, and then we come up against the actual situation, and suddenly it seems so different, doesn't it? And we feel like grasshoppers in their sight, and we're standing there just, you know, wondering what happens next. So in Deuteronomy, which we're actually looking at, he mentions these giants several times. And each of the times, there's brackets around the section. The first one is in Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 10, when he describes Moab, the land of Moab. And he talks about how the Emim formerly lived there. Emim is another name for these giants, the Moabite name for the giants. And he describes them as a great people and many as tall as the Anakim. So he's saying the Anakim, they're the ones that are in the land of Israel. They're the ones that they're going to have to fight. And he's saying there was a people called the Emim living in the land of Moab. And they were exactly the same as the ones that we've got to fight. Like the Anakim, they are also counted as Rephaim. He's saying, look, they're just like those. But the Moabites call them Emim. So the point is that in the past, he's saying, the people of Moab, they had to fight against giants too. You're not the only people who's ever had to fight a giant. The Moabites had to fight giants. And as you read on, it says, the Horites lived in Seir formerly. Horites is the Emim, the Rephaim. But the people of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from them and settled in their place. He's saying, look, let me give you an illustration. You know, you're not the first person to come against difficulties. And there's other people who've gone before you, and they're still alive, and they've got what God had for them now. So take courage, take courage. That's the point, isn't it? It says, as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave to them. And that's the thing, isn't it? That's the thing. And this is very hard for us, I think, sometimes to do. How did the sons of Moab take possession of the land? How did they overcome the giants? We're told there, the Lord gave them to them. The Lord did it. The Lord did it. Now, he refers to as Israel did to the land of their possession, and it seems like he's writing this now looking back after the conquest, but no, he's referring to the events that took place, which we heard about tonight, and also he's referred to in chapter 1 and verse 4. After he had defeated Zion, the king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan. You see, the Moabites had defeated giants, and he's reminding them, you know, you've defeated giants in your time as well, you know, when you stop and think about it. They've got some land for the first time. Did you feel it as you start reading, as you heard the reading tonight? They go from the beginning of those frustrations, and suddenly they're actually starting to win. They're actually starting to make some progress. God is starting to give them the things they've been praying for and waiting for and working towards all that time. And it's God. That's the point. God is working. He refers to them again in chapter 2, verse 20, about the Ammonites now. This is a different group of people living further north. It's also counted as the land of Rephaim. In other words, that was the land of giants. And he says, Rephaim formerly lived there. Look, there were giants there too once, weren't there? But the Ammonites call them Zamzumim, a people great and many, as tall as the Anakim. Just the same sort of things that you've got to deal with, other people have had to deal with too. And then he goes on to say, but the Lord destroyed them from before the Ammonites and dispossessed them and settled in their place, as he did for the people of Esau who live in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites before them and dispossessed them in the place even to this day. Zamzumim, by the way, is a sound like a buzzing bee. So an onomatopoeic word. It's like a buzzing sound, a deep, in other words, like this. You know, they've got big, deep voices, like this. But they're gone. They're gone. You go to the land of Ammon. You go to the land of Esau. You go to those places and you look for the giants. They're not there anymore. They're past. Why? Because the Lord destroyed them. And then it goes on to say, and as for the Avaim who lived in the villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim who came to Kaphtor destroyed them and settled in their place. I don't know if you want to follow that. In chapter 2, verse 20, he makes a little reference to people coming from Cyprus and settling in the land of the Philistines. But I want you to notice there's no mention of God. God did not help them to achieve that. They did that in their own strength. And the reference to that will be that they will not be able to stand when God comes for them. Because if the Lord delivers them into your hands, surely Philistia will be yours too. And that's eventually what happens. What did David find when he struck down Goliath? What happened? What kind of weapons did he carry? How many numbers did he muster? Who did it? Who killed Goliath? Who delivered Goliath into the hands of David? God did it. God did it. God can kill giants. God can slay giants. So Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 11, we go on to hear about Og, king of Bashan. And we read there that he was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. He was one of the giants. And behold, his bed was of iron. Is it not in Rabbah, the Ammonites? 9 cubits of length, 4 cubits in breadth. He's got a 10-foot bed, this man. An iron bed, 10 foot long. But as you go down, it's Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 13. All that portion of Bashan is called the land of Rephaim. And then he says, Jair, the Manassite, took all the region of Argob. That is Bashan, as far as the border of Geshurites and the Machathites, and called the villages after his own name, Havoth, Jair, as it is to this day. Who was this guy? Who was this guy, Jair, the Manassite? That's the point. We don't know. He's a nobody. He's a little guy. They were all small men. They were none of them particularly amazing, none of them particularly great warriors. None of them particularly strong or tall or powerful. But God gave all the land of Og, king of Bashan, into this guy, Jair's name. I can almost imagine, you know, like in the congregation, there's Moses preaching in the congregation, and he points to this little guy sitting down there in amongst them all, Jair the Manassite. This little guy. How did it happen? He gave it to him. So, I know you've heard this message from different preachers often and many times. It's not how big the giant is it? It's not how big the problem is. It's who is your God? And what's he like? And is he great? Is your God greater? Is he bigger? Is he more powerful? Because if you are supposed to win that battle, he will deliver these giants into your hands. And this is a message that the Israelites have to learn again and again and again and again. And we find it again and again. We want to do it in our own strength, don't we? We want to try to overcome, and we can't. And so we get overwhelmed and we get discouraged. But when we just come to the end of ourselves and return to God, and we look at God and we give the problem to God, everything changes. He opens doors, doesn't he? He opens doors. I love the fact that in the end, in Numbers 32, we read how Jair got to rename all the villages after his own name. And, you know, in the end, we want to have our possession. We want. How many of you treasure the testimony of God's goodness in your life? Think, and you think back what the Lord has done for you. it's almost like one of the most precious things a Christian's got, isn't it? What the Lord has done for me. And I look back over the years, and if I've got time and I think about it, and I just go, I remember when he did that, and I remember when he did that. We were talking about experience and confidence this morning. What that experience over the years, the Lord did it. The Lord did it. The Lord did it. I am weak. He is strong. We are feeble. He is mighty. We are grasshoppers. But our God is awesome. And he can deal with giants. And yes, they fought and they got involved. But they're under no illusions, are they? I know it's probably mostly for show. But sometimes when you see a sportsman, they score an incredible goal. And straight afterwards, they go... They give glory to the one to whom it belongs, to whom it's deserved. How has this happened? How have I find myself doing this? How have I ended up in this place achieving these things? How have I become the person I am? God did it. Thanks be to God for who I am today. And yes, we've got challenges ahead of us. Some of us got big challenges ahead of us. But the same God has brought us thus far. Will he not take you all the way? Some of the things we face are vast, aren't they? Some of the challenges are just our physical challenges. They're vast, aren't they? But God is able to do it. And what's the real power of the giant? What's the real power a giant has? They can frighten the living daylights out of you. That's the real power that they have. The power to make you afraid. And in the moment you're afraid, that's how terrorism works, isn't it? Terrorism makes you terrified. And when you're terrified, you cannot both be afraid and be full of faith at the same time. It neutralizes your capacity, doesn't it, to believe and see God for who he is. And if the terrorist can get you into such a state of mind that you are so afraid that you forget your God and how great he is and putting your trust in him, well, then they are going to run your life. But if you can look up and you can see him, they won't run your life. But he will deal with the giants that are in the land. But we have to believe. We have to believe. And so, can you see why he fixes on this illustration? He could have probably not mentioned some of these things, but he brings them out for a reason. Because they're going into the land and there are giants in the land. Last time they came to the border, they knew there were giants in the land and it made them turn back. But as he preaches to them, it's his purpose and prayer that next time you're intimidated by a giant, you will look up and cross. You will do it. You'll go in and you will possess the land. You will see what the Lord your God will do for you. So I suppose this is the last thing I'm saying, is that when we're preaching, when we're sharing our faith with others, when we're sharing the goodness of God with other people, isn't it that our purpose to lift up the greatness of God? Can't we just show them how good our God is from our testimonies, from past experiences, and so consequently help them to look forward and see if he's done it in the past, won't he do it in the future? If he's given you his only son, this is one of my favorite verses. If he's given you his only son, will he not give you all things? Don't be afraid. God is with us. God is with us. So, friends, we've got things to deal with, haven't we? As we leave Monday morning, coming around the corner like a freight train, and sin and hell and devil and sin, all this sort of thing is going to be railed against us. They are not little problems. These are not little problems. But we have a great God. We have a great God. We don't have to minimize the problem. We just have to recognize the reality of who we serve. We're going to sing something to close. 1127, the splendor of the King. 1127, the splendor.